Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2016, then-Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked a vote on a Supreme Court nomination by President Obama. McConnell said that the nomination came too soon, 8 months before a presidential election. 4 years later, the final confirmation vote on President Trump's nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, came in just a week before the national election. That got Republicans the key 6-3 majority on the court. But did it cost the court some of its legitimacy as an apolitical body? President Biden noted the shift last week after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade.
With this decision, the conservative majority of the Supreme Court shows how extreme it is, how far removed they are from the majority of this country.
We're talking about whether the court's powers come, where they come from, and how it has been maintained over the years. Washington Post reporter Robert Barnes has been covering the Supreme Court since 2006. Robert Barnes, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
So this didn't happen overnight. I mean, when did this current era of questioning of the court start?
Well, the court has always been questioned by people who don't like the decisions that it makes. That's, part of the American way, right? We think that the court has made the right decision when we agree with it. But the Chief Justice John Roberts, especially, who sees himself as sort of the guardian of the court's reputation and integrity, has been making the argument for a long time that as he's put it once before, there are no Obama judges, there are no Bush judges, there are only federal judges who are trying to do their best. I think what we're seeing is that there is a real difference in these judges. I can't imagine that anyone could make the argument that the changes in the law that we've seen by the Supreme Court this term and some last term are not happening because of an incredible change in personnel that we've had on the court that you mentioned. There have been three new members put on by President Trump. They have all been in the majority in all of these cases that have recently come to pass on religion, on guns, and on abortion.
Have you ever seen a president do sort of like a victory lap after a ruling as that, like we saw the likes of with former President Trump last week?
Yeah, well, he said, I'm going to put people on the federal bench who are opposed to Roe v. Wade. And as he put it, just like that, it'll vanish. I don't think anyone expected that it would happen this quickly, but he was right about that. It's interesting that while he did do that, what you said, supposedly our reporting has shown that privately he's worried about what it means for Republicans in the upcoming election.
That being that the backlash from the ruling could hurt them in the midterms.
Yes, that it could energize Democratic voters in a way that, frankly, that Roe has always energized Republican voters.
I was reading something to prepare, and the author made the point that the Supreme Court doesn't have an army. It has really only its legitimacy, the mm-hmm. trust of the public to follow the rules that it sets forth.
That's right. And the court says that itself. But Justice Stephen Breyer, who, as you know, will be retiring in just a few days whenever this term ends. We still don't know exactly when that's going to be. That's what he always says, in that it has no army. It has nothing to enforce the decisions that it makes except that people accept them. And I think, still we see people accepting these decisions. I don't see any state saying, well, we're not going to pay any attention to what the Supreme Court says. But it's clearly a dicey time for the court, and there is a lot of criticism of it from sort of all corners.
But there have been prosecutors here and there, for instance, local law enforcement officials who are saying they would not make prosecution of abortion crimes a priority in their administrations.
Right, that's true, and they have said that what we haven't seen are sort of states saying we're going to keep, we're not going to enforce sort of what the court says. Well, I mean, what we've got is, in a way, what the court's decision did and what it says, or the five members who overturned Roe, they're saying we're returning this to the states. We're returning this issue, and so if states want to have abortion rights, then they can. If they want to offer, if they want, their laws want to sanction abortion at all different stages, then they can. But they're also saying that if a state doesn't want to have abortion, it can get rid of abortion. Or I guess it hasn't gone exactly that far. We don't know if some law that didn't have an exception, for instance, for the woman's life, whether that would be acceptable to the court. But their argument is we're giving this back to the states and the states can do with it what they want.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the court and its reputation and why it matters or not as the U.S. Supreme Court forges ahead with this new 6-3 majority wrought largely from the term of Donald Trump. In office, he appointed three members of this conservative court. My guest is Washington Post reporter and editor Robert Barnes. He's been covering the Supreme Court since November 2006. Robert, I read that 25% of Americans polled in the weeks before Dobbs said they had a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the Supreme Court, which is not good. That's
good.
One out of every four Americans, or three out of every four Americans
don't. They're getting down to Congress's level, right?
Right. Exactly. And what does that portend? I mean, what do we know about, what the framers intended? Does the court talk about that much?
Well, the court really, I think, is more powerful than the framers sort of thought that it would be. Why is that? I think it's partly because of Congress and the executive and the lack of an ability to get things accomplished elsewhere. The court is always hearing cases about unclear federal statutes or presidential directives such as, the Dreamers legislation, and it's because Congress can't do anything. Congress hasn't passed anything or been clear. And so the court sort of has to step in to make a decision. But I think that you are hearing more and more criticism that the court has too much power, and that there needs to be more balance somewhere else.
Then there is what some people see as collusion, which is a pejorative, but the coordination between the White House, the Senate confirmation process, and the court. What Mitch McConnell did in 2016 is arguably one of the most cynical things I've ever seen a Senate majority leader pull. I mean, 8 months before when Scalia died, everybody assumed, and it was kind of shocking that did not happen. But what was even more shocking was his response when the next opportunity came up, and there were literally weeks before the election.
Right. I think there's no doubt that Mitch McConnell is the architect of this current court as much as Donald Trump is. He has had an incredible role in it. He feels and has always been very open in saying that he thinks of courts are the most important thing that he can have a control on, because it's going to be something that outlasts his time in Washington. Now, he would argue, he would take exception to what you said, of course, by saying that at the time of Obama's last nominee, Merrick Garland, Republicans control the Senate, and so Republicans get to decide, the Senate gets to decide whether or not a nominee is confirmed. And the same thing when Justice Ginsburg died and Justice Barrett was nominated. It was Republican-controlled Senate. And it was within its power to make those choices. But certainly what you say resonates with an awful lot of people.
Well, it was within its power, but it was blatantly political.
Yes, it was political, but that is what the, that's the way the court is set up. It is political. It likes to think of itself as non-political. The second a nominee puts on the robe, they don't like to be described as Republican judges or even Republican-nominated judges. They like to be seen as judges. But it is a political process all the way up until that point.
But historically, I keep going, but historically, but historically, the Senate has, I mean, when you look back at Ruth Bader Ginsburg's nomination process and her eventual the vote to put her into the Supreme Court, it was almost unanimously for her.
Yeah, that's right. And it used to be quite different. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You can play the blame game on who to blame that for. Is it, do you blame Democrats because of the Bork hearings, mm-hmm. which Republicans like to do? Or Democrats would point to that even with a Democratic Senate, Justice Thomas was confirmed. Democrats like to say that Democratic Senates have been more accepting of Republican nominees than the other way around. Not that there have been too many instances of which mm-hmm. we could test that. But part of this is a function of when an opening occurs on the Supreme Court and when a president gets a chance to nominate someone. And that's why you see a lot of movement these days toward not a lot of movement, but you certainly see proposals toward somehow limiting the number of years that a justice could serve so that every president gets a chance to make some nominations, or, even more of a change, expanding the number of justices on the court.
Next term, it looks like there's another affirmative action case ahead, this time in university admissions. They're going to talk about whether states violate the Voting Rights Act by not striving to create congressional districts conducive to minority candidates. And it will hear from a wedding website designer who doesn't want to work with same-sex couples. All fraught issues, right?
Yes. I mean, this is a majority, conservative majority, that has not shied away from taking on big and important and controversial topics. I mean, last week we had religion, guns, and abortion. That's pretty much, of terms work right there. Next term, we will have even more just the cases that you talked about. And so I think what we're seeing is a group that's, a new group that is conducive to it. And then two justices, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, the two probably most conservative members of the court, who have been here for a long time, and they have felt frustrated that things haven't moved quicker. And so you've got a combination there of these five justices that could go quickly.
In your experience covering the Supreme Court, it depends on the personality, but do some judges mellow over time? Do they change? Do they become, more... measured in their decisions? I know you just gave an example of Thomas and Alito, obviously mm-hmm. not in their case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think studies show that justices usually move to the left a little bit over their long tenure on the court. At least that's what the political scientists would tell us. But I think we also are dealing with a different kind of justice right now. I think the most recent nominees to the court have been people very carefully selected by Democrats and by Republicans to vote a certain way. We talk a lot about the Republican conservative justices because they're in control and they can make things happen. But certainly President Obama would be extremely happy with his two nominees to the court, at least the two who made it, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. They are vote consistently liberal and are exactly what President Obama, I think, would have hoped for with their nominations. And, you know, we see the same thing with President Trump and to some extent with the other Republican nominees on the court.
Some of the harshest criticism for the court has come from within the court, from in the dissent of in Dobbs. From I can't remember if it was Sotomayor or Kagan that wrote that, but
they all three wrote it. They all three signed their name to it. It's kind of a joint declaration.
Does that matter when the question about legitimacy is coming from within?
Well, I think it does some, and you know that was like a warning. It seemed like with them saying it's not over, despite what the majority says that this is. Is only about abortion. The logic of it could extend to other areas, you know, contraceptive, sexual intimacy, same-sex marriages. And so it was quite a tough piece. Now, we get that a lot, actually. Sometimes we're not paying as much attention to it. The justices can be very tough on each other in their written opinions, but then they sort of circle the wagons when there is criticism from the outside. What I've been a little bit surprised about recently is Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, in some of their public appearances, they usually get a kind of softball question about how the court gets along and everyone loves each other, even though they disagree. They did not take the opportunity to say that. They took the opportunity to sort of say it's a tough time on the court right now. Now, interestingly, Justice Sotomayor, who writes some of the toughest things about her colleagues, at a recent public appearance, she went out of her way to make those kind of comments. And she singled out how much she liked Justice Thomas and how she thinks that he cares about the institution. And so they are very tough on each other, but they often don't like to be criticized from the outside.
Interesting. Robert Barnes, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
Robert Barnes has been a Washington Post reporter and editor since 1987. He's covered the Supreme Court since November 2006. We are going to continue our conversation, talk with some legal scholars about the makeup of the court and its legitimacy going forward. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last week, upending nearly 50 years of abortion rights in the U.S., former President Trump took something of a victory lap, taking credit for appointing the conservative majority that sealed the deal. Trump, in a prepared statement, called the ruling, quote, the biggest win for life in a generation, end quote, and said it was only, quote, made possible because I delivered everything as promised. That is, he nominated three of the court members in the majority in Friday's ruling, Justices Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. It was a win for the pro-life movement, but many are concerned about the stain of politics on the court. Ohio State University law professor Ruth Kolker focuses on disability and civil and reproductive rights. Welcome back to the show, Ruth.
Hi, Ann. Nice to be here.
And Kevin McMahon is the John R. Rittmeyer Professor of Political Science at Trinity College in Connecticut. His forthcoming book is titled Uncertain Legitimacy, How America's Polarized Politics Constructed a Supreme Court Unlike Any Other. Welcome to the show, Kevin McMahon.
Thanks for having me.
Unlike, I'm happy to be here. Unlike any other is a strong statement. Can you talk about it? Because I know there have been other eras of politicization on the court.
Sure. I mean, the argument the argument that I make is that essentially this is a court that is historically distinct than any other. And it it is so in a variety of ways. I mean, the one that I've talked most about is this idea that the court is filled with five, what I call numerically minority justices. And what I mean by that is if what I did was I collected the votes of all the senators, right, who supported somebody like Brett Kavanaugh. And then I collected all the votes of the senators who opposed him, right? Obviously, this is a largely partisan vote. The difference is about 24.5 million votes more for those who opposed him than those who supported him, right? This is, and the fact that the five justices in the majority of the Dobbs case, the abortion case from last Friday, they are the only numerical minority justices ever to sit on the court. And they are making decisions, obviously, in this case, that are unpopular if you look at public opinion polls on the issue of abortion and generally the right to choose. So that's one example of how polarized politics have shaped this court and constructed a court that is really much different than those of the past.
So, Ruth Kolker, is this, do you have other ways, or is this how do you view this way of measuring the court's legitimacy and politicization?
Yeah, that's a fascinating analysis. And I read a couple of Kevin's pieces where he spins it out, and I recommend to the readers that they read his work. That is a fascinating way to think about it. Of course, the Constitution itself says that justices are confirmed by the Senate, and it says that each state gets two justices. And so the Constitution was drafted with this design in mind, as Kevin knows, to give the less populated states more power. So this is not an unintended consequence. This was an intended consequence, and we're now seeing it have maybe the far most reaching implications. But I guess there's an interesting question. What do you mean by legitimate? I mean, these Supreme Court justices were approved by the process that the United States Constitution provides. This isn't like some people who claim they lost an election, that they won an election that they actually lost, right? And that isn't like some far right members of the community trying to get Mike Pence to act inconsistently with the 12th Amendment, right? This is people drilling down, understanding how the Constitution is drafted and meant to work, and taking advantage of it in a way that it allows a minority point of view to construct the meaning of the U.S. Constitution.
Did the framers expect the system to be gamed in this way, do you think, Kevin McMahon?
Well, the design, the design is certain, as Ruth pointed out, has certainly been in place since the founding of the country and since the Constitution was ratified. What's really changed is the way in which the country has been expanded and the discrepancy, as you've had increases in population in states like California and not much increase in certain states like Wyoming. So you have these huge disparities between some states, again, like California having, 40 million voters or 40 million residents, and then states like Wyoming having 500,000, and they both get two senators, right? So if you can, if you can really dominate the states that are rural populations, you can have an oversized impact on the Senate. And obviously the Senate is not very proportional given those differences. And you can therefore, you can dominate who gets selected. And it really goes even farther than that. If you look at public opinion polls, if you look at exit polls in states like even very red states like Montana or North Dakota or South Dakota, and you look at the candidates in terms of whether or not they support, the voters, whether or not they are pro-choice or want Roe to be overturned. This was a question from 2018. Even those supporting the Republican nominee, right, who typically wins by large amounts in these states, are pro-Roe, right? It's the fact that, but within the Republican Party in certain many states has been captured by these sort of anti-Roe forces, and that has driven this conversation and to the result that we had from Friday.
Well, I mean, it's in its platform.
That's right. Yeah.
It can't be any clearer than that, although they didn't actually hew to the platform last time around, but be that as it may, it's still there. Let's talk about just kind of recent events and what role they've played in. First of all, how much does public opinion matter, Ruth Kolker, in the long run?
You mean in terms of persuading the court?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it used to be the case that people understood the court as being uncomfortable in getting ahead of public opinion, and that when it did get ahead of public opinion, it did so with great caution. And one reason is that the Supreme Court's decisions are not self-executing, right? They don't have a police force that can go out and make sure that people abide by their decisions. And so if they get too far ahead of public opinion, there is the possibility that their opinions won't be adhered to. And this happened from the Constitution's earliest days, Marbury versus Madison, 1803. But let me give you one example that I think people may remember or know from high school, which is that when Brown was decided, it was unanimous. It wasn't a strongly worded opinion. It was a cautious opinion, but it was unanimous. And then they just said the states need to move with all deliberate speed, which of course was vague. And despite that vagueness, Governor Faubus of Arkansas in 1957 insisted that Arkansas would not desegregate schools. A governor could arguably get away with defying a Supreme Court decision if the federal government doesn't intervene. And Eisenhower was reluctant to intervene, but he eventually did and sent in, as I think everyone knows, national troops, paratroopers, 1,000 paratroopers, to desegregate the schools. And so one could take that as an example where the court was arguably ahead of public opinion in certain southern states. And had the President of the United States not been willing to use some of the powers that he held, it could have possibly been unenforceable. And so we're at an interesting moment now, which is that Supreme Court has said that states can do whatever they want in the abortion area. Well, we've heard some state attorney generals say, who are of a different party than their state legislature, I'm not going to enforce that anti-abortion statute. So we may have some other Governor Faubus examples occur now, because the court, as Kevin said, is, I don't know if ahead is the right word, but it's not acting consistently with broad public opinion. Well, although it obviously public opinion varies state by state, and 2008 data, 18 data may not be consistent with 2022 data. I write about that in my book called The Public Insult Playbook, but that's a separate issue. But that this will be something to watch. Are we going to have resistance from enforcing state statutes that are anti-abortion, and what will happen?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Justice Roberts did caution against going too far in this regard. He thought they should be more incremental, that that's the way to go on these kinds of issues, right?
Yeah, of course, he was the sixth vote.
Right.
So it didn't matter.
He caved, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, Justice that Alito had five to fully join his opinion, Chief Justice Roberts concurred separately to say that he would only conclude that the Mississippi statute was unconstitutional, and permitting banning abortions after 15 weeks, and he would leave this issue to future developments. He obviously didn't garner, he needed to garner one more vote. I think the hope was he might garner Kavanaugh, who also wrote separately. But it didn't happen. So Alito wrote an opinion that was a majority opinion of five members of the court. So therefore, there's no caution. This is a very, very bold decision to allow the states to do whatever they want with really no floor that's in the court's opinion.
And the lack of incremental, the incrementalism in this case, Kevin McMahon, are there other eras on the court that can compare to that?
Well, I think this is, I mean, certainly you can find, you know, Dred Scott's probably an example where the court dramatically overreaches. That's probably the, you know, certainly the one that pops into my mind.
Yeah.
During the New Deal, when you have, you know, overwhelming support for Franklin Roosevelt, the court is very active in striking down New Deal legislation in the 1930s. You know, I just a reflection on Robert's opinion. Some of this is just the, you might call it Donald Trump's luck, the fact that he got three nominees. Obviously, one was because the Republicans successfully prevented Merrick Garland from even being considered for the court in 2016. The fact that he got three nominees in 4 years is quite unusual historically. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg lives for three or four more months, John Roberts' opinion is the majority opinion, right? And as Ruth was suggesting, it is more of an incrementalism. Roberts is not, he's clearly a very conservative justice, but he's concerned about the institution of the court. And I think he, as Chief Justice, he's concerned about the legitimacy and looking like this is a political court, that once they got their opportunity, and this is less than 2 years since Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed, that they've taken a decision that, overturns 50 years of abortion of reproductive rights law. And the opinion itself, Justice Alito almost ignores that fact. I mean, I read it as a justice who was thinking that he was sitting on the court in 1973, and this is how he would decide if there were never a Roe. This is much different than what the plurality opinion did in Casey, right? They wrote understanding that abortion rights had been in place for close to 20 years in 1992.
What does the role of Roberts, what, he's called the Chief Justice, but in this, does this suggest that that's a name only, that he won't be directing, guiding the court very much going forward, Ruth Kolker?
Well, yeah, it's a title, you know, and what that means is that if he's in the majority, he can assign who writes the opinion on his side. And the decision of who writes an opinion is an important decision. And Roberts is still in the majority very, very, very frequently. And he was in the majority in Dobbs, but he couldn't write an opinion that four other people would join. He had to write a concurrence that was separate. So, you know, he still has obviously a lot of influence. And, you know, maybe when things really explode in the post-Roe world, he'll be able to use some of that influence to do a reality check on the court. But I'm sure he must feel frustrated. He obviously hasn't been able to be personally persuasive for the court to be the court that I think is pretty clear he wants. But, you know, we have a really important affirmative action case coming up next term, and Roberts has been very, very strict about being anti-affirmative action. Really one of the most strict people on the court other than Thomas. And so we may see another really dramatic decision in affirmative action where he will join the other five. So it's not like he's always giving incrementalist, but I think we obviously think he would have preferred to be one on this issue.
We'll take a quick break. That is Ruth Kolker. She's an Ohio State University Moritz College of Law professor. Her work focuses on disability, civil, and reproductive rights. And Kevin McMahon, he's a professor of political science at Trinity College in Connecticut. His forthcoming book is titled Uncertain Legitimacy, How America's Polarized Politics Constructed a Supreme Court Unlike Any Other. We are talking about the court and its a legitimacy, how it ranks. What do you think? 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the future and legitimacy of the Supreme Court. Still with us, Ruth Kolker, Ohio State University Moritz College of Law professor, and Kevin McMahon, a political science professor at Trinity College in Connecticut. His forthcoming book is titled Uncertain Legitimacy, How America's Polarized Politics Constructed a Supreme Court Unlike Any Other. A lot has been made. Kevin McMahon, I guess I'll start with you, with the leak of the draft opinion on Dobbs. And that, I don't know to this if it's absolutely unprecedented. Obviously, it's certainly very rare. Why does that loom so large in this conversation or in this as we look at the court today?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say what will be the lasting impact of the leak. You know, obviously, if we discover who leaked it, that might have some more implications. I think the one thing that's important to know is that the court is a really small institution, right? There are 9 members of the court. When they sit for conference, it's only those 9 individuals in the room. There's a tradition where the most recent appointed justices has to get up and open the door and let in somebody who's, you know, come. Maybe they forgot something in their office, and now Amy Coney Barrett has that responsibility. And Justice Kagan tells this wonderful story about how one time she had an ankle sprain or something, and she was in a walking boot and didn't matter. She still had to get up and walk over and open the door, right? So when you have 9 individuals working together for many years, something like this, if there's a breach of trust, that obviously can have an impact on their working relationship. And it is a court that usually that does most of their work with the written word, right? With drafts and then exchanging drafts. So it's hard to truly know how much this leak will have an impact on the court, but that's where it would be, I think, if there is an impact.
What do you think, Ruth Kolker?
Yeah, it's really is hard to say if a clerk is the one who leaked it without a justice suggesting that should take place. It's a little hard for me to see how it affects the collegiality of the court, but. Mm-hmm. I don't buy the nefarious, views out there that Roberts leaked it or Kavanaugh leaked it or Leela. I think that's pretty unlikely because it is sort of unprecedented. It's easier to imagine just one clerk pressing the send button. We did have a unanimous opinion at the end of the term. You know, there is still some sense of them working together on issues of statutory interpretation. I don't see any strong evidence that collegiality is much different than it's been on the court in the past.
From the public's point of view, the impact, I'm curious about your thoughts about the impact of blocking President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland, and then with 8 months to go, and then in the term during Trump's term with weeks to go before the elections, going forward with the Amy Coney Barrett nomination and putting that one through. Ruth Kolker?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of consistent with what I've said before. Those are the rules of the game, right? We give the Senate control. They can decide whatever a majority of them decide that they want to do. And, they played the playbook quite masterfully to maintain the maximum amount of power. Will the Democrats, if they are given the same opportunity, play the same game in the future? Probably, right? They'd probably be criticized if they didn't. This is certainly a destruction of the notion that nominations to the court are about what's best rather than politicized. And as Kevin knows better than I do, there's been much more politicization of the appointment process in the last 20 years than we have seen historically. We used to have some justices appointed by Republican presidents who then became fairly moderate and or even progressive. And we haven't seen that recently, that they have done a better job of fielding their candidates in a way that preserves the political point of view they want to preserve.
So what does it, though, Kevin McMahon, then do to the agency of the court when it's when something like that happens to the public? I mean, we're only going to be around for a couple generations, but the history books will remember it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I mean, this is certainly not the widespread opinion, but I think there was precedent the way the Republicans blocked Merrick Garland in 2016 was different, but there was sort of a precedent. If you look back to 1968, there was somewhat, Chief Justice Earl Warren retired. Lyndon Johnson appointed his replacement and he was filibustered. His name was Associate Justice Abe Fortas. So there was sort of precedent in holding up an appointment in an election year. The way I see it is, if the Republicans were not going to confirm, or at least a few Republicans were not going to vote to confirm Merrick Garland, it was probably better that they just didn't speak with him, because the opposite, and certainly the experience in 1968, was to try to destroy Fortas's reputation, which they successfully did, and he resigned from the court soon thereafter. So now Merrick Garland is the Attorney General, right? His reputation was not destroyed in a way that Fortas's was, and there were certainly some reasons to destroy Fortas's reputation, but nevertheless, it wouldn't have been part of the conversation if he weren't appointed to replace Earl Warren. I mean, long term, we have a broken confirmation process, and I think part of that is just how long the justices are serving. Right, they're serving for very long periods of time, much longer than they have in the past, and when you have that power, I think it's hard for individuals to step down, and we saw that with Justice Scalia, who died in office in 2016, and we saw it with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died in office in 2020. President Obama did sort of gently try to convince Ruth Bader Ginsburg to step down. I believe it was 2014. She chose not to, right? And I think when you have that sort of randomness of a vacancy, and justices like Justice Kennedy sort of playing the game of when they decide to leave, it just invites itself to have these confirmation hearings that are just both very divisive and not very informative in terms of what the justice is going to do once he or she's on the bench.
A couple of proposed reforms have been floating around. One is a mandatory, I guess, a term limit, and another is expanding the number of members on the court, expanding the size of the court. Ruth Kolker, I mean, are those, I'm sure those have been bandied about before. Is this not particularly new? It's just because the court's so much in the news right now.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, during the New Deal era, expanding the court was given serious consideration, but not, that didn't occur. I honestly don't quite understand why people think that those kind of changes would make such a difference if you are politically progressive. If we expand the court and because of the constitutional design, the Electoral College, Republicans are still more likely to win the presidency and are more likely to retain control of the US Senate. Expanding the court would, of course, just potentially give more seats to people who are even more politically conservative. And the same thing with term limits, that would just increase the frequency of appointments. And if Republicans control the presidency and the Senate, then that just gives them more power. So yeah, we're in the short-term posture. We have a Democratic president and a very, very narrow majority of Democrats in the US Senate. And most people don't think that that will last, much longer. So, fine, people can get angry about that and talk about it. I don't really see why that necessarily makes any changes that would change the dynamic that we're currently seeing.
What do you think, Kevin McMahon?
I certainly agree on the court packing. Ruth mentioned Brown versus Board and Southern resistance in the 1950s. I believe there was one proposal by a senator or a congressman from the South who wanted to expand the court to 500, right? So the idea, you know, if you want to talk about undermining the legitimacy of the court, you know, that's a way to do it. So, however, in terms of the term limit, I do think the proposal of an 18-year term, and where you have established points in which people would depart from the court, it gives each president, you know, you have nine justices. They every 2 years you get a vacancy. The vacancy is sort of can be predicted, right? When people go right to the polls, they know who's going to be leaving the court. And that each president gets two, each presidential term, a full term would get two appointees. It's still a very long time. In fact, traditionally, that's about how long justices served. It allows for a much greater diversity in who gets chosen, right? Right now, if you're 55 years old, you're probably too old to be appointed to the court, right? But some of the greatest justices were appointed when they were in their 60s, right? Ruth Bader Ginsburg was 60 years old. Earl Warren was 60 years old. Louis Brandeis was 59 years old. Oliver Wendell Holmes was 60 years old. So, and these, obviously, many of these individuals lived a long time ago. So age expectancy has been expanded. So it allows for a greater diversity just in terms of age, of people who could be chosen for the court. And it allows for this, allows for voters to understand how the court will change in the next 4 years. And you don't get this gaming of the system, right? That I'm gonna wait. You know, Scalia openly said that he did not intend to leave the court as long as there was a Democrat in the White House, right? I mean, that it's if you really want to try to lessen the politics on the court and the confirmation process, I think that would be one way of doing it.
Justice Clarence Thomas is always grabbing headlines, most recently because of his wife, a well-known conservative activist, and there's questions about the leak in that regard as well, and just, you know, how bound up they are in politics when, you know, even as he is a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you guys think about that aspect of it? That seems very new and unusual, or at least unusual to me, to have a spouse attracting so much attention in this regard. Ruth?
Yeah, I haven't followed that closely, how Ginny Thomas compares to other spouses. I mean, given that most Supreme Court justices have been men, so historically their spouses have been women who may have been unlikely to have done much work outside the home. So, you know, maybe there's some sexist history explaining why this is a new development. I mean, I'm more concerned about her potential role in January 6th, which obviously Congress is investigating. And I don't think she gets a get out of jail free pass just because she's married to a Supreme Court justice. You know, I think she should be bound by the law like we all are as American citizens.
Yeah, Kevin McMahon.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, Clarence Thomas is a pretty private individual. And he, the fact that Ginny Thomas is getting a lot of attention, many of the individuals who sit on the court now have spent a lot of time in Washington, right? They are, you know, they either as clerks or working for administrations or on the Court of Appeals at the DC Circuit. So this is just going to be couples have more active spouses in the workplace, I think this is going to be something that will continue. And it's something that senators have to deal with, or congressmen, members of Congress have to deal with as well.
Kevin McMahon, political science professor at Trinity College in Connecticut, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And also Ruth Kolker, Ohio State University Moritz College of Law professor, thanks for your time today. As always, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann.
That's it for now. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.